I'm Robin Daly. This is the Yes to Life show, the show that looks at any and all aspects of integrative medicine for cancer. The show's named after the charity Yes to Life that I established 10 years ago to try and fill the yawning gaps in care that I experienced when supporting my daughter through cancer. In this week's show, we look at possibly the best established and also one of the most controversial alternative treatments, Gerson therapy. Any hack journalist wishing to deride alternative medicine for cancer will immediately trot out a joke about carrot juice and coffee enemas to extract an easy laugh from the evidence-based fraternity. But what about Gerson therapy? There is a reason it's been around for so long. I've personally met quite a few people who have used Gerson therapy exclusively to effect a remarkable recovery. And then there are the amazing stories of Beata Bishop and Michael Geerin Tosh, which they tell in their books, Time to Heal and Living Proof. To find more about it, in this show, I shall be talking to a very experienced Gerson practitioner. So I come down to lovely Kew by the river in London to meet Catherine Alexander, who's here for a couple of weeks on a whistle-stop tour of Britain from Australia. So I thought I'd take the opportunity to come down and meet her here and to find out a lot more about her very extensive experience, both with Gerson therapy and with naturopathy generally, particularly with relation to cancer, of course. So, hello, Catherine.
Good morning, Robin.
Yeah, lovely to meet you for the first time. And, you're well known for being connected with Gerson therapy. I did a little bit of reading and saw that you originally trained with Lawrence Plaskett, who some listeners will know of from his work with dietary work in Britain. And but then you subsequently trained in Gerson, and you actually were director of the Gerson Institute, is that right?
I was, yeah. For about 18 months.
Yeah, and but you've since trained also in advanced naturopathy.
I did. Well, yeah. When I went to, we emigrated to Australia in 1996, mm-hmm. And you have to redo all your exams.
Uh-huh.
So I did the naturopathy.
Right.
So that's why I had
so
that
specifically to work in Australia.
Yes.
Yeah. I understand. Okay. So you work very strongly with your website, it seems, in your connection to the world. You're not isolated out there in Australia. As you just mentioned to me as we were talking earlier, you work a lot on Skype. So you're helping people all over the place. And with a very broad range of conditions, I understand as well. So.
Yes, normally people who actually find me or come to me have tried everything else.
Right.
And then they hear about me and it's like, it's the last ditch because it actually involves the patient taking the reins,
mm-hmm.
making massive lifestyle changes, particularly with their diet.
Mm-hmm.
And so most come when they have tried everything else.
Right. Okay. So obviously, Yes to Life, we're helping people with cancer, so and that's why I know of you, because of your work with Gerson, which is specific to cancer. How much of your work is actually with cancer patients? Is it mostly, or?
It's a good 60 to 70%.
So the majority.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. So you would describe yourself as you're working to help people sort of generate their strategy as to how they're going to approach disease, and helping them build a good strategy, and this would involve possibly a wide spectrum of treatments.
It does, because in my work it's very patient centric, it's not therapy centric. So although a patient might come to me and they know that specifically I change the diet, so that changes conditions in the body so it can heal itself, I also have to work with the patient's criteria. So it might be lifestyle, or it may be because they've been given a particularly poor prognosis and they may need to put in integrative medicine or even take conventional medicine, particularly if they haven't got a long time frame. Because when we're talking about natural therapies, they don't work quickly. So if the tumour's growing and the patient's been told, you know, if you don't do this, you're going to be dead within 6 months, then obviously the patient has to make an informed decision. And I prefer to work with patients who've actually looked at all their options in that situation, so that we're not caught on the back foot. So if the tumour was to suddenly grow and the patient said, oh, well, I didn't know it would happen within that time frame, then everybody loses out, but mostly the patient. So it's very patient-centric.
Good. I mean, that's the kind of need for understanding of the real criteria that the patient is working with is so important for them, isn't it? Because they can just be in la-la land in a certain way in terms of what their approach might be at any given time. They might be in an emergency, but actually acting as though they've got another couple of years.
And that's the thing, is a specialist may not actually point out to the patient the risk of acute events. So unless the patient actually says, what's going to happen to me and within what time frame if I do nothing, then the patient won't know.
No, you have to ask the right questions.
Exactly. And there's probably about three or four key questions which will give enough information for a non-medical person to make an informed decision about how quickly they've got to act, and then they make their choices from that. I actually, in probably over the last 9 years, I've been writing a book called The Smart Patient Journey Roadmap.
Yes.
And it's completely treatment agnostic and condition agnostic. So it doesn't matter what you've got, it's a strategy or a framework so that you can make really fast, informed decisions and match treatments that will get you to where you want to go within the time frame. So it's it did take a rather long time to write.
Well, having looked through it, I know why. It's extremely comprehensive. So, I hope we will talk some more about your book. I mean, you just threw something out there, three or four questions. Well, come on, give us some ideas. What are these three or four questions that somebody would need to ask in order to...
Well, the first one is, what's going to happen to me if I don't do what you say? Now, then you'll get the full range of what's going to happen, because they'd be very keen, usually, for you to take their treatment. So that's the first one. The second one is, what's going to happen to me if I do what you say? And then you get your prognosis with treatment. So very often, if the patient feels they've got time, they can use that as a benchmark. So if they say, right, well, we've got, you know, I've been given a year before the disease might come back or get to a stage where I need treatment. So within that year, I can choose to do maybe my diet, maybe they want to add some other alternative treatment in, but then it means you've got a thing to monitor that treatment. So those are the two main questions. And from that, once you've got those, then the other questions come. For example, you'd be looking at side effects of drugs, and then a patient may think, well, maybe I need to take that drug, but maybe I could mitigate the risks of that drug with a different treatment. So they're getting a full understanding, not just of their diagnosis, but of where it's going to take them and their condition.
Okay, very useful. Right, so look, well, first of all, to say, well, I'm very interested to hear, I mean, the way you're talking about all these different approaches to cancer. I mean, yes to life, we're supporting people with integrative medicine. That means it doesn't really matter who's supplying it or what banner it comes under. Is the question is this actually going to help me at this time? And, you know, as you say, well, what's the bigger picture around it, and what else do I need to do? So that's fantastic, and that's what we think people actually need. You know, they're caught in this horrendous crossfire between, you know, orthodox and alternative medicine. You know, very often both sides slagging each other off. And it does nothing for the patient whatsoever. They just get lost in amongst it.
Totally lost. Yeah. I mean, what people forget is that we don't really care about scientific research. We want clinical outcome. And I often say to a patient who's been perhaps to many practitioners, well, and they might have felt disappointed, I said, well, what did you ask them? Did you ask them if the treatment would shrink your tumour? And that's another really simple thing, is how far is this treatment going to help me? Is it going to be just adjunct? Is it going to do nothing? And those are really critical things for the patient to know. Otherwise, they could subscribe to those treatments with, and then miss out on the core treatments.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about Gerson now, since you're so closely aligned with Gerson. So Max Gerson was clearly a genius, was clearly kick-started the whole movement for treating chronic disease with diet and nutrition, seems to me, I would say. And his work's had enormous effects in the whole world of naturopathy and general healing methods with cancer, I feel. He's one of the best known alternative therapies out there. Not many people, if you talk about alternative cancer treatments to people, most people haven't even heard of one, you know. But if they have, it's probably Gerson therapy. So I'd like to hear what drew you to Gerson therapy, why you were interested in the first place, how that came about.
Okay, well, when I studied with Lawrence Plaskett, it was in the very early days in 1986. Mm-hmm. Actually, the course and the principles of the course were based on Dr. Gerson's work, where you're using food as medicine, basically. Low sodium, high potassium, restricted but not deficient protein, and low fat, and no chemicals. But of course, after I did the course with Lawrence, we were using quite a lot of supplements, which was fine. But when I went into practice, I discovered that I wasn't seeing all these healing inflammations that we learn about in naturopathy. You know, if you cleanse the patient, they're supposed to enter into this phase of detoxification, and then you get the healing inflammation, and then the patient gets better. So I decided to go back and have a look at Dr. Gerson's work, and I persuaded Charlotte to let me go on the course, because technically they were only taking doctors. So that's Charlotte Gerson, the daughter of Max Gerson. And I did the course over in San Diego, and then I started to practice, and I never looked back. So with my work, the thrust is diet. Supplements may be adjunct to that. And I've had many cures in cancer and in autoimmune conditions, and then other chronic inflammatory conditions.
Can you maybe be precise about what you learned, what you took on board when you went and trained with Gerson that you hadn't already got, you hadn't already found out at that point?
Well, it's the application, it's the appropriate application of a program that is so high in potassium and so low in sodium, and all the juicing and then the coffee enemas. So although you can have the principles within the naturopathic training, you have to apply it in a therapeutic manner. It has to be enough to make a difference. So when a patient goes on the Gerson therapy, you're going to see after probably 6 weeks that flushing of the toxins and hopefully a healing inflammation. It does take a lot longer now to get that healing inflammation, sometimes 15 months, because patients are that much more deficient and toxic than they were in Dr. Gerson's day. The other significant difference is that we're monitoring the healing process and not the disease process. So the disease process by default regresses as the healing process progresses. So it's a question of, you know, a lot of patients come to me and they say, is it going to work for me? And I always say to me, it depends on your capacity to respond to the treatment. And I give an analogy. I say, let's take two people. They've got the same diagnosis, say it's pneumonia. They both go into hospital. They both have the same treatment. One person recovers and the other person doesn't. The difference between the two people isn't the diagnosis, it's not the treatment, it's the capacity to respond. And that's what we're doing with Gerson therapy. We're rebuilding that inherent resilience and reactivating the immune system so that the body can then fight its own disease and rectify those imbalances. And I think that's a very important point, because where we've deviated with naturopathy, I've actually separated class. I've called the one side classical naturopathy, which means you change the body through diet so that it can behave normally, to the modern naturopathy, which is so product-centric and pays lip service to actually, you know, you are what you eat. If you eat Smarties, even if you take a load of supplements, your body's going to be made of Smarties. You know, people forget that the actual building blocks of the body is the food that you eat, not the supplements that you take.
Mm.
So there is that separation, and for me, I'm deeply committed to rebuilding the body through diet and not through supplements or, you know, the latest green smoothies and all those powdered things.
Yeah, interesting. So it's about real food, which of course is increasingly hard to get, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So you say we're served a bit of a double whammy, in as much as the food generally is deficient, even when we try to get good food, there's a tendency to be deficient, and we're getting more toxins than ever before to deal with that food.
That's right.
So it's we're in a double bind, really.
I try and encourage people to grow as much of their green vegetables as they possibly can.
Right.
I noted it was quite a few months ago, I was reading in the newspapers that in France, with all the new properties that are going up in certain areas, they're saying that they either have to have solar on the roof or roof gardens.
So a lot,
and in Asia certainly they're building a lot of gardens on rooftops. So I think people will take the initiative. And because that's what it's going to take, is for adoption by the masses.
Yes.
And then that is like governments and corporates often follow trends. They don't lead them, they try and lead them, but then the people say, we've had enough of poisoning ourselves.
Well, I think it's going that way because people have much more of a voice now than they ever had before. There's a bit more genuine democracy around than there used to be, because we can actually say what we like and we don't like, fortunately. So, not to assume anything, many of our listeners will know of Gerson Therapy, will have heard of it, but not everyone. So I wonder if you can briefly just say, well, what are the major building blocks of Gerson Therapy? What's it doing? Why?
Okay, so the basically you're taking probably around 6 kilograms, 5 to 6 kilograms of vegetables a day. Half of that's going to be done in juicing with apples, and the half of it's cooked. So there's all the raw food, if you like, is in the juices, and then you eat cooked foods and very small raw salads. So it's not a raw food diet. So you're getting quantity, quality, and digestibility. And so if the digestion can take the nutrients from the food, then the body can heal itself. So that's the first thing. There's very little grain. We do oatmeal and rye bread, and then at a certain point in the therapy we add in dairy in the form of cultured products like yogurt. But there's no fat in the diet other than a bit of flaxseed oil. And then of course you balance that capacity, what you get from having this type of program, and there's added potassium salts in the juices, is you get a flushing of toxins at cell level. So we're not talking about liver detox or kidney detox, we're talking about all the households in the town, which is your body, putting out their rubbish. So you're forcing it out through the cells, that then goes in the circulation to the liver, and the liver has to then detoxify it via the bile. Now what Dr. Gerson found, interestingly, was that he put patients on this type of diet for other chronic conditions, but when he started treating cancer patients, he found that they went backwards on the program, so their disease became worse. And that's because cancer creates toxins 24/7, plus releasing the toxicity from the cells, the liver couldn't accommodate it. So then he started looking for methods to support the liver, and I suppose this was his genius, is that he actually knew what he was trying to do. He knew what was occurring and what needed to be supported. And so then he started giving the patients the coffee enemas, which enabled the patient to progress very rapidly with the diet. So on the full therapy, there's 5 coffee enemas a day with 13 juices. And then the supplements that he used were to support that process. They weren't to make good deficiencies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so coffee enemas, strange idea to some people. What are they about? Why coffee enemas?
Well, the coffee enema will facilitate one of the liver detoxification pathways. I always say to people, imagine the liver is like a big motorway with 6 main lanes coming out. So the 6 main pathways, there's one pathway that can be stimulated by the coffee enema, which is the glutathione pathway. So it's a bit like opening a lane and letting a lot of traffic through.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem, if you don't do that, you get a backup, and then the liver says, oh, I can't cope, and it shoves it back into the system, and the patient actually can have toxic overload, so headaches, nausea, feelings of flu, aching joints, they just feel terrible, and very they can get very emotionally disturbed.
Mm. Okay, so obviously he worked very intensively with his whole regime, and he developed it to a certain point. My understanding is that Gerson therapy is fairly much as he left it. It hasn't particularly changed since Gerson found out what worked and passed it on, which in one way makes sense. If something works, it does, why fix it? In another way, a criticism, if you like, that comes from some people is about the fact that, of course, the science has moved on considerably, and the understanding of what's happening in the human body has moved enormously. And, you know, maybe if Gerson was still alive, he'd still be tinkering with it and changing it according to new understandings. So maybe you'd like to say something about your view of that.
Yes, I would. I mean, I don't think we've moved on. I think we've moved backwards. Maybe our understanding. But if you imagine Dr. Gerson was at a certain point and patients were at a certain constitutional point when he started his program, now we're at a point further than that. So I look at it like if a patient's in the sea and the tide, which is the disease process, is pulling them further out, you have to stop the tide, you have to get them strong, and you have to get them swimming to shore, which is cure. Now, in his day, say you were 100 yards from the beach. Nowadays, we're 200 yards. So you're looking at how do we support the constitution to bring it to a point where it can actually respond to the treatment, because we're looking at self-healing. So you would be looking at other treatments. Are they going to stop the tide from taking the patient out? Or are they going to help the patient get to that point where they can respond? So I would look at adjuncts in light of that in the context of Gerson therapy, definitely.
Right, so you're saying that then that Gerson therapy stands on its own for the job that it does, but you may need some other help to get you to the place where it can do that.
That's right, yeah. That's right. Okay. And if there's very deep deficiencies in the system,
mm-hmm.
Then you may want to supplement with things, and I'm not opposed to that. I mean, one of the sad things is that Dr. Gerson, we don't practice the therapy as Dr. Gerson did, because he put in raw liver juice.
Mm.
So you're looking at 750 grams of raw liver a day that was juiced. Now, if we were to go back to doing that, which should be possible, then we would have grounds for actually saying, well, is the Gerson therapy, as Dr. Gerson practiced, still less effective? I think we'd get much better results if we were able to do that.
Mm.
But the logistics of actually getting those young calves' livers fresh, you know, and a regular supply are becoming increasingly difficult.
Mm.
But it should still be possible. You know, for the farmer, they obviously need to know that they've got a market for it. But I still have patients who do their best and get it when they can.
But there's no other alternative which does that job in the same way, you feel?
No, I don't think so. No. I mean, I have in desperation with some patients put in raw egg yolks with their carrot juices, particularly if they're allergic to things like dairy, so they can't put that in.
Mm.
But no, I don't think there's an alternative to it.
Okay, so diet is probably one of the most hotly debated subjects in health of all.
It is.
Isn't it? It's really, there's all sorts of different churches, and, but, you know, maybe one of the most hotly debated topics is to do with whether diets need to be tailored to body types or any other groupings, or whether kind of one size fits all approaches, you know, certain things are true about human beings and they apply all over the planet or not. So I wonder if you could talk about that a bit and in relation to Gerson.
Yes, well, it depends always on the patient's endpoint. Okay, so if a patient wants to improve their health and become and get off drugs, you have to make sure that the diet they're on is going to take them there. I had I was up invited to Cairns, which is in North Queensland, to do an expo, and there were lots of lectures during the day, and I was doing one lecture on Gerson, and there was this other man who was really brilliant scientist. He was an head of Australia naturopathic schools, and he was talking on longevity and the high protein diet. Okay, so there was a forum in the afternoon where we were both asked to be on the panel, and this lady put her hand up and she said, well, she said, I've listened to both of you and you're both saying completely opposite things and I'm totally confused. So I'm thinking, So I looked at the man and I said, oh, you go first. So he gets up and he does all his explanations and all the biochemical pathways. And I'm lost by this time. I mean, I have a fairly good understanding of biochemistry, but it swamps your brain with material. So then comes my turn and I say, well, I really can't follow on from that. I said, but I can tell you as an audience that if I have someone with a chronic disease who's got arthritis or you know, some other inflammatory disease, autoimmune disease, if I was to put them on that diet, the high protein diet, they would get worse. So I said, for me, and actually the auditorium erupted with clapping, which I wasn't expecting. Mm. But it's the clinical evidence. So I always say to patients, you need to work out where your endpoint is, what you want to achieve. So for example, my husband, who wanted to lose weight, got some things out of the waste paper basket when I got, you know, you get some leaflets and handouts from various supplement companies. And it was the keto diet.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And I said, oh, rubbish, and put it in the bin. And he said, oh, let's have a look at that. And he started looking and he said, oh, this is fantastic. I could do this. And he said, does it work? And I said, if you want to lose weight, yes, it does work. So he said, well, I'm going to go on this, because he travels a lot. And so he went on it and he lost an enormous amount of weight. And he was religious with his little keto sticks. You know, you have to make sure your acidity. Well, you know, 3 months later, taking him to hospital with kidney stones, I'm driving along and he says, oh, do you think it was the diet? And I said, I'm not even going to answer that. So I say to a patient, you have to make sure that losing weight actually takes you, it's a goal, but it actually takes you to your endpoint where you want to improve your health. So you have to factor in the high protein diets. Where is it going to take me? Now, well, there's enough evidence to show that it causes osteoporosis, that the body actually needs carbohydrate for energy, so it creates a huge acidity in the body, and the body has to buffer that. And over a period of time, it has a very deep erosive capacity. So you might lose weight, which is a symptom. You might reduce your cholesterol levels, which is a symptom. You might reduce your glucose level, which is a symptom, but it's not going to treat the cause of why those symptoms are there. So that's what I say to patients when I'm teaching them or helping them to make wise choices. I actually help them to formulate their endpoint in principle. And normally the two things is they want to improve their health and get off drugs, or not end up in a situation where they need to take them. So then we work backwards from that.
Okay. So, yes, you mentioned a ketogenic diet there. So obviously that's directly related to the idea of glucose and cancer and reducing. It's used in cancer more and more at the moment. There's a lot of interest in it. And, you know, directly related to the idea of taking away the fuel for cancer. So Gerson therapy is not thinking like that.
Well, the whole hypothesis is fundamentally flawed.
Tell me why you think it's flawed.
So I often say to people, if you fed a child sugar and that was it, would they grow? And they say, well, not very well. They'd grow very badly, because a child or anybody needs protein for renovation and for growth. And tumour tissue is the same as our body tissue, except it doesn't have an off switch.
Mm-hmm.
Tumours use protein for growth. They might use sugar for energy, but they use protein for growth. And there's so much evidence to show specific amino acids. I mean, Thomas Talberg has a whole research based on certain proteins or amino acids being stimulants for tumour growth. Dr. Gerson talks about it, because the whole thing about dairy and or casein and cancer was raging when he was working. It's not a new thing.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is that tumours require sugar for their energy, but they require protein for their growth.
Okay. So maybe we can broaden out a bit now and just talk about integrative medicine for cancer and the thinking behind it, its strengths, why people would want to look in that way. I mean, we've said a little bit about the describing, well, you have one particular approach, which is Gerson therapy there, but it actually, under many circumstances, can't do its job because you haven't reached the sort of starting line, if you like.
Yeah.
And that's a role in which completely other kind of approaches could be helpful. Maybe you want to say a bit more about how orthodox medicine and other types of approaches can contribute to an overall program, at which points that each of them is useful, and how they create a whole.
Well, if a patient needs to shrink their tumours fast because the disease or that tide is very strong, then obviously the only thing that's going to do it within a short period of time is something like chemotherapy. So if the patient doesn't have time, or if nothing else can be... if the patient doesn't have time, that might be an option. When you're looking at other alternative therapies, you're looking to see what the research is or what the clinical evidence there is of it helping and how it's going to help the patient. So, for example, a lot of people will have IV vitamin C as an adjunct. Well, does it work? I don't know. Does it harm? I don't think so. So then we can try it. A lot of the studies that they use the vitamin C, you know, they promote vitamin C, were done on much higher doses, therapeutic doses, you know, taken on a daily basis over a three-week period of time.
Yeah.
But the results weren't to increase overall survival. You know, so it's like, what does it do? So when I'm a patient, they've got a limited budget and they're looking at adding things to the therapy, we have to make sure that they choose things where we know or we have a confidence that it's going to make an impact. So in my practice, I use quite a lot of enzymes. So I will add those. I don't know how much benefit they have, but I'm quite... a lot of the research, particularly the stuff that came out of Germany in the 1980s, is very compelling. And of course, the work that Gonzalez does in America, he uses a lot of enzymes, and it's very compatible with Gerson therapy.
Right. Compatible in what way?
What Dr. Gerson says, the framework, is he says that anything that can support the parenteral digestion of tumours is where I'm going. So with the enzymes, what we now know is that it reignites the immune system. The immune system in cancer isn't deficient, where people think, oh, we need to boost it. It's not deficient, it's paralysed, because it's engorged, if you like, with so many tumoral... What tumours do is they shed their antigens. They shed their receptors. Now, normally the immune system should dock on to the cancer cell through the antigen or through the receptor, and then it should devour it. Well, what the cancer cell does is it says, oh, we'll just shed them. And so the immune system picks them up in midair, if you like, and there's no cancer cell on the end. What the enzymes can do is they can quickly help the immune system or those immune cells disengage. So you get these complexes called antibody-antigen complexes, and while that's occurring, that suppresses the whole immune system communication network. So enzymes have quite an important role in that, as well as there's enough information to show that certain of the enzymes like the trypsin and the chymotrypsin, along with papain, can have a profound effect at digesting cancer cells.
Okay, so could you say a bit about judicious combination, if you like, of, say, you talked about chemotherapy, say you work with a patient and you make a decision together that a course of chemotherapy would be helpful. Presumably you also offer a lot of support.
I do.
During that period.
Yeah.
And can you say a bit about what that support is and how, in what ways it helps the patient?
Okay, well, I don't do Gerson therapy with the chemotherapy because it puts the patient into a very catabolic state, just the chemicals themselves. So we would increase the protein, but we do about 6 juices a day, 2 enemas, and there's been a great study done with coffee enemas in conjunction with diet and chemotherapy. So it was a matched, they had 38 matched pairs. It was done in Austria,
mm-hmm.
by an outpatient oncology department, and they compared the two groups. Both had chemotherapy, but the control arm did just the chemo, and the other arm did the chemo, the diet with juicing, no supplements, and coffee enemas. And the results were quite remarkable. The difference was remarkable.
In
so
terms
we
of
do
what the impact,
well,
of the chemotherapy.
Yes, they didn't have to stop the chemotherapy on that group.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, whereas sometimes they do because of liver damage or bone marrow suppression. There were less complications from the chemotherapy. There was faster recovery, and the overall survival was much greater. And that was a difficult thing for Gerson practitioners before that study came out, because we had no idea whether doing coffee enemas while you're doing the chemotherapy would actually make the chemotherapy leave the body, so it would reduce its effectiveness. But actually the opposite was found. And I've also found that with patients, when they do that program with the coffee enemas and then they come off the chemo and then we start the full Gerson therapy, they don't have the really heavy detoxification reactions that can actually finish people off if it's not managed properly.
Yeah.
So probably 5 months into therapy on a patient who's been pre-treated with chemotherapy, we start to see the chemo coming out. So it's like having a second dose. Now, patients who've done the diet and the enemas while they've been doing the chemotherapy, they're not carrying that burden.
So it's actually doing the job as they go along.
It's absolutely fantastic.
Well, it does make sense, of course, to, you know, chemotherapy is pure toxin, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And it's intended to be. So obviously if you can get away, you know, find some means by which you actually deal with that on an ongoing basis, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so... maybe before we finish, we're going to talk a bit about your book, which is 9 years in the making, as you say. I haven't read every page, but I've had a pretty good look at it, and it's extremely comprehensive. And it's not just about cancer, is it? It's for any patient, any disease. You know, how do you manage this situation? How do you find your way through? And it's, you know, absolutely replete with charts, diagrams, all sorts of flow charts and things in order to find your way through the decision-making process. It's the hard stuff, you know, it's literally how can I navigate through this, particularly with cancer, incredibly complex landscape. How can I find a way through here that's doable and it's actually has a good chance of working, you know, achieving what I want to achieve? And in fact, what do I want to achieve? That's the kind of question you actually get down to, which is so important. So maybe you want to say a bit about the book as a whole and what your aim is for people who buy that, what you're hoping to achieve by producing the book.
Well, it's interesting, but I have to say that I could never have written that book if I didn't know that people could heal themselves. Because actually, because we don't know what works, there's no evidence. That's why everybody's in a pickle, whether it's a practitioner or a patient. We just say, we'll try this. It is a try this and see. So there's very little collated studies, particularly with alternative medicine in a clinical setting. So because I've seen the power of the body to actually heal itself, and then you're dealing with many patients, probably over the last 30 years, I've dropped into a patient advocate role where we're trying to work out the best route for the patient when they're mixing therapies. And what happened was that I would create questions for them. So every patient, it was a different set of questions. I'd say, ask your oncologist this or ask your doctor this. But it was in a way where we're trying to make an informed decision, not to put the practitioner in a corner, because we want to find out what's going to happen, where that practitioner may see that patient heading, so that we know the time frame in which to act. And then I noticed that there were generic questions coming out, so I started to save them all. And so that was the beginning of the looking at the roadmap for any patient with any condition having to make a choice between what's going to work for me. And so the book evolved as a consequence of that. With first of all, it was just little roadmaps for people where I'd do their end point, their starting point, and then their goals and their criteria. It's like, oh, I can't do that because I can't afford that, or mm-hmm. You know, I can't afford to take time off work. So then you just start narrowing things down, and people then started to actually understand that it's the only industry other than probably the legal industry where we take a back seat. You know, I say to someone, if you want to build a house and you've bought your piece of land and you go to the architect and you say, this is my budget, this is the sort of house I want with so many bedrooms, and the architect said, oh no, you can't do that. Mm. You know, we're going to build it down there with it all north facing, never get any sun, and it's going to take twice as long and cost you twice as much, and no, you can't have that particular furniture in it, you're going to go and find someone else.
Right.
All right. And that's what the thing is. I mean, there's a wonderful quote by Professor Kate Lorig, who was actually the instigator of the expert patient in this country. So she had this notion that just perhaps patients, if they manage their own condition, would be cheaper. All right. So then Samuel Gray in this country took up that and they developed the expert patient program. But what she says is that doctors will get off their pedestals when patients get off their knees.
Mm.
All right, now what I noticed about patients is that they stop going to the doctor, but they're still on their knees with an alternative practitioner. They're still believing and wanting to believe because they feel that they don't have the medical expertise. But actually, if you're building a house, you don't need to be an architect.
No.
You don't need to be a builder, but you have to be able to ask the right questions.
Yeah, yeah.
And they don't need to be in-depth medical questions. And so the book evolved by my desire to really empower people. I've always been patient-centric. I've always stood on the side of the fence of the patient. Sometimes I put my practitioner hat on. But generally, I've always worked in collaboration and partnership. Because for me, first of all, the patient's right to choose. And secondly, their capacity to choose has to be fundamental.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's right in line with our thinking at Yes to Life. Okay, well, look, just to say that full details of your book will be on our website. It's called Smart Patient Journey Roadmap. I'm sure many people would be interested to look at that themselves, and because I know there's a lot of confusion out there, so anything that can help people find their way is much needed. As kind of, if you like, that's almost the reason that Yes to Life exists, is because of that thing. I've had that experience of trying to find the way through all that stuff. I know how impenetrable it is and how difficult it is, and how very fundamental things like, well, what's the person? What's the viewpoint of the person I'm asking the question of? Because if I don't know that, I don't know the basis on which they're giving me the answer. E.g., if I think I'm trying to stay alive and they think you're going to die, they're going to give you quite a different answer. You know, their basis for answering your question is completely different to the reason you're asking it. So, those sort of things are incredibly important. And of course, we have to sort all of this out. Like that, if we get cancer, because we go from not having cancer to having cancer from one day to the next, probably, and suddenly we're in this completely foreign territory. We have no idea how to navigate it. So, well, look, I think that's all we've got time for today. We covered a bit of ground. I feel like there's an awful lot more we could have talked about, but it's been very interesting. I really appreciate you giving us the time to give us some of your experience and wisdom from the years, and I hope our listeners will also appreciate it. So thanks very much indeed, Catherine.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, that was a new experience for me. I've never spoken to a Gerson practitioner before. I've certainly learnt a few things. Now, if you want to comment on any aspect of the show, please email us at radio@yestolife.org.uk. We always love to hear from you. Full details of the books, etc., that were mentioned during the show are going to be on the Yes to Life website. Just go to Yes to Life, yestolife.org.uk, and click the link to radio in the left-hand sidebar. Do also take a look at the Yes to Life section of UK Health Radio's Health Triangle magazine here on the UK Health Radio website. Next week, I should be speaking to scientist Rob Verkirk about the toxins in our environment. He's an expert on this. I shall be trying to find out from him what are the biggest hazards, the things we should be most worried about, and of course, most importantly, what can we do about these? Thanks very much for listening. Hope you can join me next week. Goodbye.